the web at WBAI.org.
Yes, indeed. Pacifica coverage. And that's where you're tuned to. 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org. Coming up at 2 p.m. will be the Arts Magazine Talkback with Hugh Hamilton at 3 o'clock. It's now 1 p.m. in New York City. My name is Michael Z. Haskins, your radio host and guide. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And I'm always intrigued by Manjito Lee and his attitude and approach to health. As many other people, you know, there are just certain people who don't question. They don't question, and when they don't question, I run into a little trouble with people because they don't ask the question. Bernie Siegel once said that a tragic error in medical evaluation is that doctors are thought to observe and think, but not feel. Today, I'm going to have as a guest Dr. Alan J. Hamilton. Alan Hamilton is a Harvard University professor, Harvard-trained brain surgeon. He currently holds four partner professorships at the University of Arizona. And he's his primary appointment is professor of neurosurgery, as well as being oncology and all the other stuff. Now, Dr. Alan Hamilton claims that there is more to medicine than just medicine, than just as we see it. And he talks quite a bit about the spirituality of it from a few different angles. So let's welcome him on and let's say hello to Dr. Hamilton. Hi, Alan. Are you on the air with us?
I am. Hi, Armin. How are you?
Good. So let's talk. I mean, you know, surgery is such an interesting thing, and I heard you say it, and I think someone else said it as well, that really surgery is luck, that the primary factor of surgery nowadays is, are you lucky enough to be the 9 out of 10 people who pull through without any hitch? Are you lucky enough not to get an infection? Because there is a matter of odds and percentages. Could you address that issue?
Well, I think it's luck in the sense that there are so many unknowns. We start off with the fact that who gets what disease is often just a matter of good or bad fortune. We all have friends who are, you know, in the prime of their life and then suddenly something goes wrong. So there's that element of not knowing why certain things happen. There's the good luck, for example, of having a tumor or a heart surgery that goes incredibly smoothly. Now, obviously, surgical technique has something to do with it, but I always remind myself that when people are watching me in the operating room and go, oh, my goodness, look how well that's going, and I go, you know, part of that is just that we lucked out, and the tissues dissect very well, and the planes are all there. And I think luck is a way of, to some extent, admitting, I think, with some humility, hopefully, that not everything's under our control. Not everything that we do, not everything that where we consult, where we seek technical services, not every aspect of that is under our control.
So when we speak to a patient and you say to a patient, well, this should go fairly well, we're going to remove your prostate, mm-hmm. and that'll help you with your BPH, and everything should work with a little bit of luck.
With a little bit of luck, and
but nobody would ever say that to a patient, would they?
Well, I'm actually surprised sometimes. There was a study that used videotapes, and they actually showed that the average patient, from the time the surgeon walks in to the time the surgeon walks out and is listened to them, done a physical history, and gotten them consented for surgery is 7.5 minutes.
Wow.
I think one, there's a couple of things that I would point out to a patient. Never trust a surgeon who says nothing can go wrong. That just strikes me as so arrogant I'm just taken aback when somebody says that.
How about never trust anybody who says nothing could go wrong?
Right. And then the last thing to remember is I think it's the 20th rule or guideline I gave in my book, which is there is no surgery like no surgery. Surgery is always taking a risk. It can be a small one. It can be a very large one. But there's always this component of risk or luck, as we were talking about, and you just can't enter into surgery without having that in your mind.
But there are some people who enter into surgery like, I won't even go into cosmetic surgery, but something like, you know, carpentry, like a hip replacement or something like that, mm-hmm. that they say, you know, it's really kind of a simple surgery, and it's the odds are so poor that anything would go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying there is nothing really that simple because there's always a risk factor when you open the body. It's because invading the body or cracking open the body or cutting through the skin opens a whole world that doesn't want to have invaders and they rebel?
Well, it's a whole opening, if you will. It's making a crack in this sacred temple. And every time, no matter how small that crack is, there's the opportunity for something to gain access. I have time for a brief story?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We had a patient who, he and his wife were a young couple. They were done having children. They decided that either the wife was going to have her tubes tied or he was going to have a vasectomy. They made a very good surgical decision. Vasectomy is far more minor procedure, less risk. He underwent the vasectomy. Everything went very smoothly. He was perfectly healthy. A couple days later, he notices a little redness. He goes to see his urologist. The urologist puts him on antibiotics. He says, I want you to come back next day. He comes back next day. The urologist says, this isn't going the way I thought. Let's put you in the hospital. Long story short, from that vasectomy, his whole bloodstream got invaded. Eventually, his heart valves got invaded. I ended up getting to know this guy because he developed abscesses in the brain, and he ultimately died. And all of those events were traced back to this incredibly simple, minor procedure. And I went back and looked and looked and looked. Everybody did their job. But it was a matter of just a lot of bad luck.
Well, would you say bad luck? I mean, I know we don't like to say that it was bungled. But, I mean, if all antiseptic procedures are followed, doesn't it mean bungle? Doesn't it mean it's not just luck, or it may mean that there was a sack of something waiting to be released on the inside, or are we saying that somebody messed up a little bit? It's okay if doctors mess up because that goes with our statistic. But are you saying that now, if everybody were perfect, if everybody did a perfect job, still some number of them are going to be, you know, not have good results?
There's two parts to your question. The first is everybody isn't doing everything right.
Right.
And there is a massive effort underway. It's too little and it's too late, in my opinion. 250,000 people are going to die this year from medical adverse events, which is five times more than on the highways of America. And to some extent, medicine's got to wake up and say people cannot tolerate a medical system with that many mistakes. We know that surgeons and doctors can get rid of and reduce a lot of infections. That said, not every one of them. And not every one of them is due to a break in technique or error. Some of it is just due to the fact you're invading the skin, and when you do, anything can get in there. Any kind of infection can set in. And, you know, we all have had scratches where, you know, the next day they're a little redder, and the next day they're a little redder, and they all usually resolve. But they can tip the other way.
My guest is Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of The Scalpel and the Soul. Fascinating books for anybody who might be interested in surgery for any number of reasons. Well, of course, now that brings us to a big question. We may talk about botched techniques, Alan, but you're also saying, you know, there are some other factors. What if he got some kind of a... If somebody is miserable and negative and they're surrounded by negative, just psychological factors, if a person, let's say they're depressed, might they recover less quickly if they're depressed than if they're not depressed? We'll go on to the other stuff, but would you consider that the psychological attitude of somebody going under the knife has got a big contribution to whether they have favorable outcome or not?
Armin, I think that's an enormous factor. I mean, if you take two patients, hypothetical patients, and one, I go in the room at night before surgery, and there's the family there, and they're laughing, and there's photographs of the children, the grandchildren, drawings from the grandchildren on the wall, and everybody's bombarding me with questions because they want all of their questions answered, they're all engaged. That's a patient who's surrounded by a positive support system. If I go into the next room, and I see a glum, sullen patient all alone. Nothing in the hospital room has any identity from this person. There's nobody there. The patient, when I say, do you have questions about the surgery tomorrow? No. I'm just do what you need to do. And I look at that. If any surgeon who is asked which of those two patients is going to have the most complications, it's going to be the latter. It's going to be the depressed patient. We also know depressed patients have decreased immune systems. They're immune systems don't work as well. Literally, their white cells do not kill bacteria as effectively as the white cells from people with an upbeat, positive attitude.
Well, wouldn't it make sense then to give somebody a shot of speed or something before the surgery so that they start laughing? I mean, if the attitude's going to make that much of a difference, you may as well medically correct the attitude. But they don't do that.
Well, I think attitude has a lot to do with it. I think we have to take responsibility as patients, as family members, as loved ones, that we want to create as much positive energy and enthusiasm as we can for the person we love or for ourselves if we're the patient. Norman Cousins, as you know, pioneered his own treatment for ankylosing spondylitis. He was told it was untreatable. There was nothing he could do but live with it. And Norman Cousins launched into this program of basically making himself watch movies that he found very funny, you know, and he watched, Buster Keaton and the Three Stooges and, you know, just had this long list of funny films, and he created this kind of laugh therapy for himself. We know that people feel less pain when they're laughing than when they're not laughing, and I think, if you're watching the news at night, on the day after your recovery from surgery, and I walk into your hospital room and I see, you know, you're fixated on disasters, on war, on the stock market, and everything that's making everybody anxious, because that's what the news is for. It really is aligned very much on, here's another story you can be anxious about. And then I sort of say, you know, is tonight the night you want to listen to that? Can you go for a few days without that? Because let's get all our emotional energy as positive as we can and focus on recovery. So I think attitude has a lot to do with it.
So having a surgeon who's also a stand-up comedian might be helpful. What are you doing here?
It'd be the best of both worlds, wouldn't it?
All right, just to take that just a step further. One of the recent surveys I read was about, I'm sure you're familiar with this, wives, women, people who have mates that are in the room with them recover less slowly than people who don't have their mates in the recovery room with them.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Could we talk about that? Because that doesn't make sense to anybody. If we're saying positive attitude and love makes all the difference, well, there are people who are better off without their husbands and wives when they're in the hospital. And why is that?
Well, statistically, when you look at people who are married and have a close relationship and a successful marriage, those people statistically, on average, live about 4 years longer than people who are single or have lost their spouse. Why does it make such a difference having a loved one in the room? Well, first, we know from pediatrics, where we first learned that, hey, it helps to have a family member in the room, present, that makes the patient less anxious, it makes the procedures easier to do. That's the first reason. The second reason is that having somebody that you feel close to and you love in the room is often going to make you feel more at ease. You're going to require less pain medicine. You're going to feel calmer. Those things obviously have an impact on the speed of recovery in the recovery room and in the ICU. And then last but not least, there's this unknown factor, but very important, which is what I call the guardian angel factor. When you're in the recovery room and you have your loved one sitting right next to you, they are focusing, they are advocating everything on your behalf. They're going, they said that they were going to bring pain medicine, and that was 5 minutes ago, and it still hasn't arrived. The doctor said they were supposed to start another IV, or the doctor said he was supposed to get an asthma treatment. And I tell all of my patients, appoint a guardian angel and have them sit and watch everything, every drug that goes in your body, write down when the doctor said he'd come by, what tests were supposed to be ordered that day, why weren't they done at 4 o'clock when they said they were going to be done at 4 o'clock. That is a very important factor in making sure that your recovery goes as smoothly as possible. And let's be honest, nobody keeps speeding when they see the highway patrol under the bridge, under the underpass. And it's the same thing in medicine. If people see that the family's paying very close attention, they know that, number one, they're interested, but they know that they're going to be held accountable for everything that goes on, and they pay quite, you know, they pay closer attention to it.
They also, I think it's also a line that you have to draw, because the person who's in between you and the services has to be a graceful person. If they go antagonistically to the nurse's statement station, yeah, they may be responded to, but they also get, you know, they get shut out. They don't get cooperation. So it's somewhere in the middle. If you're going to have somebody sit with you who's going to be your advocate, don't let them be a maniac.
Don't let them be a maniac. And I always say chocolate chip cookies go a lot farther than bitching.
Sure.
To put it bluntly.
Sure. So you want to engage. You want people to know.
Yeah, exactly. And these nurses, by and large, are, you know, the best advocates for patients. They're the ones who will bug a doctor if they don't think something's going right. They're the ones who will call the nursing supervisor if they think something's amiss. You know, make them your ally, please.
One of the leading nurses here in New York, Teresa Palmer, brings to my attention the role of spirituality and hope, which is what your book is about. Can you just address first? Let's talk about hope. Is positive hope, I mean, what does hope mean? I mean, it's just such a funny word. Is it Panglossian? Is it like just saying everything's going to be better? Because that's a horrible thing to do to somebody who's dying.
No. I'll tell you a story that's in the book. It's not particularly flattering to me, but I thought it was an important story to share about the meaning of hope. I was taking care of a young man who had very aggressive brain cancer. He was a former athlete. He tolerated the surgery beautifully. He went through a very strenuous course of radiation and chemotherapy and was doing very well for quite a while. No recurrence. And one day he took me aside and he said, Doc, you know, I know I'm going to beat this thing, but if ever there comes a time, I want you to tell me when it's time to go fishing. He was an avid fisherman, and he said, I just want to know when it's time to go fishing. And then he looked me in the eyes, and he said, you know what I mean, don't you? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, and you promise? And I said, I promise. And he went on and did very well for several years, and then, unfortunately, the tumor recurred with a vengeance, and we had to operate on him multiple times. One time he came in a coma. We had to operate emergently. And the tumor was spreading not only to the other side of his brain, but up and down his spinal cord. And after one of these many, many surgeries, he was getting ready to be discharged. And I noticed he was alone in the room. And I went up and I said, you know, remember a conversation we had several years ago? And you told me that when it was time, I was supposed to tell you it was time to go fishing. And you looked at me and said, yeah. And I said, well, it's time. And the next morning, his mother called me, and he had died during the night. And it wasn't because I was such a great surgeon and knew the prognosis. It was because what happened is I cut the thread of his hope. He saw me lose hope in him, and then he lost hope in himself. And nobody has the right to take away another person's hope. A lot of people say to me, well, you promised. And I said, yeah, I did, and I was young. I said, today, if I had it to do over again, I'd ask him to come to me when it was, when he felt it was time to go fishing.
And because there's a part of you, let me understand this, Alan, there's a part of you that believes, even if you knew there was a fatality, even if you knew there was no way out, even if you saw a person on their deathbed, you know, who was just on their way at to the great exit sign, that you believe there are other powers, other forces that might intervene as long as you could keep the door open to the possibility of hope and not close the door. Is that what you're saying? Are you saying there's forces greater than I who could bring this whole thing into a reversal without my going beyond my medical knowledge?
I think every doctor, every nurse, every healthcare worker has seen a situation in which we all said, this is hopeless, this is the end, this will never go anywhere but to ultimately culminate in a death. And then watch a patient miraculously turn around. Watch a patient that we said was going to be paralyzed for life walk. And we go, we can't take away hope. Hope is the desire to prevail against overwhelming odds. There is no such thing as false hope. And we don't have the right to remove that hope. I'm not saying we should lie to patients. But the truth of the matter is there are things that happen that we can't predict.
Well, but you're saying not lie. But if a person says to you, Doc, am I dying? Are you going to avoid the question?
No. Yeah, I can say, you know, I think that this illness is gravely is serious. And there's a very good chance that this could go on and bring about your death in a very short time. And then I say, if I had a dime for every time I miscalculated when a patient was going to die or misjudged, I said I'd have a much bigger bank account. I had one man who absolutely had the worst-looking CT scan. His tumor was invading everywhere. It was growing from one side to the other. The literature said he'll be dead in 6 weeks. We arranged for him to go to hospice. At the end of 6 months, director of hospice called me up somewhat embarrassed and said, we really are having a hard time keeping this guy here because normally we don't keep people here for more than 6 months. So I brought the guy in my office and I said, I've got some great news for you. You flunked out of hospice. Now, I would have predicted he would not have survived 6 weeks. He is alive 13 years later. Well, his tumor just stopped growing in a way that I cannot explain biologically. But there's the evidence in front of me that everything I thought was going to happen with this tumor was dead wrong.
Well, you see, now that brings some understanding to me. The question I always have about a person kind of trying to make peace with themselves and with their family is a family goes in and they see somebody who's obviously dying, and they say, and the person says they know they're dying, but the family says, you're going to get better, and they say, yeah, I'm just going to get better, I'll get out of here, but they're lying to their families. Yep. And I found so many cases where the person is deeply relieved when people say, let's talk about your death.
Armin, you're absolutely right. I tell a story where I couldn't let go of a patient. I was having a very difficult time letting go, and patients need permission to go. I can't tell you the number of times we've seen a patient who is ready to go, who says, I have to wait till I say goodbye to my son or my daughter or my husband or whatever it is, and they need that closure before they leave. And you're absolutely right. To cling desperately for your own needs is sometimes inevitable. I mean, I think a lot of families go, I don't want this person to die. I don't want them to depart. But at the same time, there is a time to say it's okay to let go, and it's okay to go and pass over to whatever happens after this life. And, you know, it's a balance between hope and letting people die with dignity and respect and peace and a sense of closure in this life before they go on to the next.
My guest is Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of The Scalpel and the Soul. Okay, so you say rule number 8, don't be turned into just another patient. How, if people are in hospital or if they're getting attention, how can you avoid it? Do you wear red colors or something? It may not be a bad idea. You know, wear bright bandanas. Don't be another patient.
Absolutely. I think hospitals try to make you into a nameless entity. They take away your clothes. They take away all your jewelry. They take away your identity, and they put you in that stupid hospital gown with the opening in the back so your butt's hanging out. I tell my patients, don't. You don't have to do that. Your individuality is a part of who you are. Your individuality is a part of your illness or your surgery, and we want that to be manifest and express it loud and clear. I always think about that red hat society of ladies, and it's the same sort of thing. You know, wear your favorite T-shirt, wear your favorite sweatpants. Don't go around in those paper slippers they give you in the hospital. Wear your bunny slippers. Have pictures up around you that remind you of what moves you, that reminds you of all of the things, the wonderful things you want to live for. But, don't just become that disease that's in bed 435. Because that, ultimately, a hospital will let you be treated like that. And I think when we all know that when we're ill, when we face a major surgery, that is not just some biologic process. That's happening to us. That's happening to a total individual. And that total individual needs to be manifest so that we deal with it as a disease in an individual.
Rule number 13. Avoid all negative influences. Avoid negative influences of the people in the neighborhood. What negative influences might there be?
It can be anything. We all have, for example, we all have friends, at least I do. I have one friend in particular that I adore. But every time that I'm with him, he's sort of a negative Nancy. You know, it's this isn't going to go right, and that isn't going to work, and I don't understand why this happened. And there's just a lot of complaining and whining and so I wouldn't say to my family, let this guy come over on my first day after surgery, because I have to put up a lot of energy to defend myself against him. I have other friends where I just feel like I bask in their glow, that they're embracing me, that they're practically carrying me, even when I'm perfectly in perfectly good health. And those are the people that I want to surround myself with. I don't want to be watching, television on my first couple of post-operative days that's filling me with angst or that's dealing with murders and disasters and kind of. I want something lighthearted. I want something inspirational. I want my music around me. I want my music to soothe me. When I'm doing my physical therapy, maybe I need a little Rocky in the background. So I can get up and down the hallway, whatever it is that I have to do to recover. Those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about taking responsibility for the energy that we allow to around us.
And there's the difficulty. Times. The difficulty is if you have somebody who you're related to, who loves you deeply, and they see you in physical trouble, and they see you going through a surgery, sometimes their nervousness just kind of feeds through, and there's no way that they could control it. And you as a patient have this additional burden of having to keep them calm, at the same time. So sometimes having your mate there is not such a good idea if they're going to be too nervous.
Well, Armin, I think you put your finger right on the issue. That is, let's say we do have a situation like that, and you go, I'm facing this major surgery, and I'm trying to keep a peaceful, calm, quiet focus, and I have this other individual that now I'm now becoming responsible for their state of mind. And think about, okay, so right before this or right during recovery or while you're dealing with cancer treatment, all that energy is being drained by somebody else. I can't, for example, I often will talk to cancer patients, but particularly breast cancer patients, and they'll say, I'm getting treated, and I'm going through chemo, and I'm going through radiation, I'm going through everything I am with breast cancer, and yet my family seems to resent that I've had to sort of close in around myself, and they feel as if they're being selfish because they're focusing on recovering from cancer. And the point is, you know, they need to be able to have permission, if you will, from the family to say, hey, Mom, you really do need to focus right now on your recovery. That's the most important thing in the world. And the rest of our needs are going to have to take a back seat. And sometimes it's amazing how guilty the patient feels.
My guest is Dr. Alan Hamilton. Alan, we have to take a short break. Stick
sure.
with us. You're going to be hearing us, but you will have an open mic just in case you happen to have anybody passing by. But we're going to take a short station break, play a short bit of music, and then come right back with Dr. Alan Hamilton.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations.
Five,
that's TalkBack right here on
three,
WBAI
two,
New York.
One.
Church on Sunday morning, Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast, might fall on a piece of glass, might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hand. Grandma's hand soothed the local unwed mother. Grandma's hand used to ache sometimes and swell. Grandma's hand used to lift her face and tell her, she'd say, baby, Grandma, understand that you really love that man. Put yourself in Jesus' hands, Grandma's hand. Grandma's hand used to hand me a piece of candy. Grandma's hand picked me up each time I fell. Grandma's hand, boy, they really came in a handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have Grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for Grandma's hand.
Mm-hmm. And this is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind. We're talking with Bill Withers, who's giving us some advice about healing, which brings me back to Alan Hamilton speaking about the scalpel and the soul. His book, we were talking about general medicine for a while and what it's like to go through surgery, but now, Alan, let's dip into that other world. And I want to just give you an example of this and see where you match with this. I was working with a patient who has a multiple personality disorder, and one of the things about working with multiple personality disorder is you access different personalities through a form of dissociative hypnosis. And so when talking to different personalities, included in the personalities is usually one person who is the caretaker and another personality, because they're separate and distinct, which is the spirit personality. Now, of course, you could say anything you want about whether or not it's a true spirit. But that person in talking once gave some advice, and I said, I asked, when this person, I'll call her Joanne, was sick, I noticed that you weren't present. And she said a very interesting thing. She said, we, the spiritual part of us, tends to, when the person's really sick, we tend to leave the person. And so it was kind of what you said. We tend to just go away while the body is sick, and we come back after the body as well. And that's an interesting concept. Because my question became the whole idea of people feeling dispirited, or they look like, you know, there are certain sick people who look like they have no soul, that they're kind of, something is gone, their spirit is gone. Address that for me, would you?
There is, I think, two camps. One is that many patients, and this was a lot of what inspired me to write the book, because I've learned from them, many patients will enter into a severe illness or a major surgery, and it will bring about a spiritual crisis, as it were. It will bring about an opportunity to look at their life, to look at their values, to look at their legacy, and it can often serve as a gateway to spiritual transformation. And I've seen many of my patients go through that, and candidly, their challenges, their spiritual issues made a reflection back on me and actually brought about challenges in me, made me question what I was about, what my values were, and what my commitments were. The second thing is this issue that you brought up, Armin, that I think is very important, that this is the patient who is dispirited, the patient whose spirituality has abandoned them, that the body is under siege, and almost as if some of the mind's powers have taken the back door and escaped when the fortress was being attacked. Those patients are the ones that I get very worried about. Those are the patients whose defenses are so depleted that you wonder, well, how are they going to be able to rise to the occasion? And you know, we all just finished watching the Olympics, and I always say basically crown this athlete as the best or better than average. They crown them as the gold medal best in the world, and we all at one time or another are capable, as it were, of an Olympic performance. And when we surmount illness, that's when we want to be at our gold medal best. And the dispirited patient is devastated. They are not the ones who are going to be winning that gold medal. And those are the patients where I really want to try and attend to their spiritual state, their emotional state, talk to them, find out what's going on. What is it about the illness that is making them feel dispirited? Very often it's other outside emotional issues, and it can be this spiritual crisis that has caused them to feel depleted. Their strength abandons them.
But you also believe that there are outside spiritual forces, and you're even in touch with the outside spiritual forces that are part of surgery, and you talked about a vision in the shower you were having. Mm-hmm. Let's go to it. It was very daring of you, but it's really the essence of your book.
Right.
More than all this that we're talking about, which is very, very valuable, of course.
Armin, I think we all have different experiences that we can't explain. I always liken this to I'm going for a hike in the wilderness. I'm looking around me. I'm looking at the mountains. And then behind me comes Ansel Adams, looking at the same landscape, the same trees, the same mountains. And suddenly he's able to see all the magic and the power that was in there that I glanced by. I had an opportunity one morning. I was driving into work, and on the road on my way into surgery, there was a dead rabbit, and there were these three vultures that were just by the roadside, shredding the carcass. And the image grabbed me, as you can imagine, and I drove into work. And I'm going into the holding area and saying good morning to my first patient, and he's there with his wife, and I'm telling him, we'll see each other in the operating room in about another 10 minutes. And I'm leaving, and they're getting ready to wheel him out, and as they are, the wife bends over to give her husband a kiss goodbye, and she says, "Don't you worry, my little bunny rabbit, you'll be fine."
Wow.
And all of a sudden, this image from the morning drive somehow crystallizes in my head, and I just had this terrible feeling about that connection. And I go out to the front desk, and there's a nurse there I know, and I said, look, just do me a favor, humor me. I didn't explain to anybody what was going on. I said, just humor me, and let's push this patient back later in the day. I want to scramble the schedule a little bit. And I went back out and explained to the patient that I had to move him, and please forgive me. Long story short, he had a massive heart attack 2 hours later, waiting. And fortunately, he was right in the hospital. We rushed him up to the coronary care unit, and he did fine eventually. And 6 weeks later, I did operate on him. But he would have had that heart attack in the middle of brain surgery. It would have been very, very difficult to treat it under those circumstances. And, how did it happen? Well, you could call it luck. You could say it was this intuition. It was this little omen. But when the little hairs on the back of your neck stand up, you should listen to them.
So we're saying that an omen is by your saying it, that there is some force that if you train your ear to listen to it, that you will get a sense. Now, that sense could be your intuition. It could be all the culmination of all of your knowledge with information that you don't even know about, like you didn't notice that his eyebrows were turning color, and that usually means a heart attack, which is stuff that you've learned from many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was actually contact with that force, that force that you're talking about that is available and part of the entire healing process.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. It's sort of like why does Ansel Adams see something that in the same landscape that I didn't? And the answer is his eye is trained. I think the universe is constantly sending us signals, and for most of us, we're deaf to it. But there are times when those signals break through and they're louder and sharper. There are other individuals who are more in touch. Their ear is better trained to hear those whispers, if you will. I do think the universe talks to us in a variety of ways. And, a lot of it depends on how open we're really willing to be to those forces.
So if you have somebody says to you, I got a funny feeling this isn't going to work out very well. I have a funny feeling there's something about this I don't like.
Yeah.
You don't know where it comes from. It could come from there basically being a very frightened person. It could come from paranoia. Mm-hmm. Or it could come from some kind of information. It could be that by delaying a surgery, you're actually killing a person.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're listening to a spirit. There is a way you have of discerning what you think is the right information versus instinct and something else. How do you do it? What do you do? Do you open your ears in a certain way? Where do you get your information from?
Well, let me go back to the example because I think it's an important one. If I have a patient who comes to me and we're getting ready to go into the operating room, and that patient says to me, I have a very bad feeling, or I had a dream last night I was going to die, I'm not going to do that surgery. I'm going to postpone. I had it happen. Patient said to me, I have a terrible feeling that something is bad is going to happen in the surgery. And I said, okay, it's my particular personal issue, but I want to hold off doing your surgery because I don't like the fact that you're having that feeling. And then we went back and we found out that there was some really, really terrible things going on in terms of his clotting mechanism, and that when that number came back, I was just so grateful. I think, how does the universe speak to us in a variety of different ways? I told a story in the book about a young boy who was a burn victim. He was in a coma. He had never been out of this coma on a ventilator. We were trying to keep him covered with skin grafts. It was becoming impossible. He was dying from overwhelming infection. In the middle of this, his father, who was quite young, dies suddenly of a heart attack. The mother calls and says, would there be any point to harvesting the skin from his father and covering him with that? And it was a last-ditch effort, and we thought, well, why not? We did it. About 2 hours after we finally finished this surgery, getting this young boy completely covered, the nurse comes pounding on the door, obviously very anxious, and says, you've got to come to the bedside, something's wrong. So I run to the bedside, And I'm looking, and this boy's eyes are open for the first time. And even though his hands are completely wrapped in bandages, he's obviously struggling to get the tube out of his windpipe. So I undo the knot and take the balloon down and take it out. And the very first words out of his mouth to me, we've never even looked at each other before. The very first words out of his mouth is, "What's happened to my father?" And I was an intern at the time. I made a mistake. I thought, I'm not going to tell him first words that his father's dead. And I said, "Your father's fine." And then he said, "Are you sure?" And then I began to wonder, and I said, "Well, yeah, but why do you ask?" And he says, "Well, why is my father just standing there at the end of the bed looking at me?" And obviously I turn around, and I can't see anything. And then the whole impact of what I've done kind of, you know, comes crashing in, and I said, "I have to tell you that your father died suddenly of a heart attack." And then the boy said, "Well, that must be his ghost. That must be his spirit that's smiling at me and watching over me." That boy went on to make a miraculous recovery against every odd imaginable. I lost track of him, as happens in surgical training, because I had another 10 years. On the very last day, I'm going up to the 12th floor of the Mass General Hospital to hand in my beeper with the communications office. And I get on the elevator, and there's a woman that I recognize. And standing next to her is a teenager who obviously had been a burn victim in the past. And I realize that's the mother, and the teenager was the boy that I had taken care of 10 years ago. And I'm going, and I'm saying, this can't be happening to me by mistake, just by coincidence. There has to be. This is the universe reminding me not to sweep under the rug what I've seen, and just to remember what I was a witness to. And those are some of the things that you know, I'm a scientist, I'm a brain surgeon, but these things happened, and I don't have a good explanation for them, but I do think we need to open up a dialogue, because I do believe the universe speaks to us in lots of very subtle ways, and we can't take care of our patients when they want these spiritual and emotional issues at least to be discussed.
Well, my guest is Alan Hamilton, author of Scalpel and the Soul. Alan, you also talk about possession syndrome. You also talk about possession syndrome, and you talk about it from two levels. I would like to know, if when doing surgery, do you ever come back, you ever come and get in touch with somebody's being possessed? You know, that there's a, that something is released. If you're doing brain surgery, do you see things happen beyond what just looks like normal medicine? That's one question. Second one is, you made reference in your book about being possessed yourself by the spirit of a dying or dead patient.
During surgery, for me, I don't have the feeling that the patient is possessed. I do talk to my patients during surgery sometimes. You know, I may say, "Well, we're coming to a part where, you know, I want to take some time and I want to think about what I'm doing." And I certainly have prayed during surgery to help me make the absolute best decision for this patient. I often will say to the patient, you know, things are going very well, you can relax, things are going just the way we had hoped. That's that part. The possession part was just a weird experience for me. I had taken care of a young boy that I was very close to, and I decided to take some vacation, and you know, I knew he was in his last days and he was going to die, and I decided that I didn't want to leave town. And he did die. And the next morning I had the day off because I'd taken some holiday, and I was reaching for a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden I feel like I'm struck by a lightning bolt. I just absolutely fall to the ground paralyzed. And there's just these electrical shocks going through my legs, and I'm convinced I must have just herniated a disc or something terrible, and I'm lying on the floor, I can't move, and eventually there's a knock at the door, and I thought it was like the UPS guy or the mailman or something, and in walks an old friend of mine who is a Navajo, and he leans over me and says, "I'm going to go get help." And I thought, you know, he's going to bring a truck around or get me loaded up or get an ambulance or something. He comes back about an hour and a half later with this gray-haired elderly gentleman and introduces that he's a very powerful medicine man, a Navajo medicine man, and he's brought him to attend to me, much to my surprise. And in fact, the medicine man doesn't speak any English. He only speaks in Navajo, and my friend is translating for me. And then he starts, looking over me and says, we're going to have to do it, treat you, and you need to get to your feet so you can get into a chair. And I said, I can't move. And he says, yes, you can. And suddenly, to my surprise, I'm able to get up. I'm having a lot of pain, but I couldn't move before. Now I have a lot of pain. I sit in a chair, and he has me take my shirt off, and he positions me, has my family sitting in kind of a semicircle around me. And then he starts a smudge ceremony where he's burning sage and other things and has a feather fan. And I start breaking out in this horrendous sweat just pouring off of me. And then he's working behind me, and I feel as if his hands have started to move inside of me, but not in a threatening way or a painful way. The only way I can describe it is really that there was this sensation of pure love moving through me. Now, I had not said a word about what had happened the day before with my young patient. And suddenly, translating through my friend, he says, you're holding on to the spirit of a young boy. And this young boy needs to depart, and you were not willing to let him go and pass over to the other side. And he's desperate for you to let go, and he is kicking and trying to get free, and that's where your pain is from, and you need to give him permission to go. And so he took me through this whole ceremony, told me what to say, and then suddenly I feel all the pain literally draining out of my body. Now, for a neurosurgeon, for a brain surgeon, this is a very, very unusual experience for me to have sensed it myself. Now, how do I explain it? I just tell it, just the way it is. That's the only thing I can do. After we're done, my friend says, it's kind of customary to prepare a meal to thank the shaman, the medicine man. I look at my watch and said, my goodness, it's 11:30 at night. My friend reminds me, he said, well, that didn't stop, this medicine man from coming as soon as you needed him. And I said, yeah, you're right. And I said, well, how about, can I make a spaghetti dinner? So here we were nearly midnight. I made a spaghetti dinner. We're sitting around the table with the Navajo medicine man eating a spaghetti dinner. And it was wonderful. And my back pain and everything else seemed to have completely vanished. Do I have a good explanation for it? Not necessarily any better than the one that the medicine man gave me himself.
So maybe all of surgery, might be a little bit of a farce. Maybe it's just the actual intention of the medicine, of the medicine man yourself, you being one, that when you work with people and you do your work, the other stuff, sure, it makes a difference. But perhaps one should always question the integrity of the surgeon. And by integrity, I mean, do I want somebody who's just a sharp thinker, or do I want somebody who's somewhat connected to themselves, somewhat connected to the spirit? And it would seem to me that most surgeons, of course, that I know are not, or they don't show that. But it would seem that there would be, it's almost essential if you are somebody who is letting somebody futz around with your brain, open up and doing surgery on it, you may want to know, hey, are you okay with anything greater than you are? And of course, there are so few people who would even admit to it. So I think you bring a very important element to the idea of healing.
Something
that I think is a strong consideration. Alan, I want to thank you for being with us. We will have this program on the Internet by later this afternoon. So if you go to the website, thepositivemind.com, you'll be able to download it and send it to anybody you want to. And the name of the book, The Scalpel and the Soul. Hefty reading, my friends. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., and we'll have more interesting stuff if you want to send me an email. Armand@brainlink.com. And Alan, do you have an email address?
Yes, I do. Alan Hamilton, AllanHamilton.com.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye. Thank you, Armin.
Sure.
Heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5.